This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thanks for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. It is Friday. It is time to check in with our philosopher, because this Sunday, Jack Russell Weinstein's show, Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, will be the Prairie Public Presents presentation. That's 5 o'clock Central this Sunday on our radio network, and we're going to talk with Jack about this Sunday's subject, which is very intriguing, Jack. Describe this week's topic for our listeners.
Well, the question we're asking is, how does misinformation spread? And I guess another way to phrase that is, why do people believe fake news? So it's a timely topic, and it's a really compelling one.
And you picked the authors of a new book, The Misinformation Age.
They're a pair of philosophers in the Department of Logic and Philosophy of Science, actually, at the University of California in Davis. And I liked the book in part because while we're talking about fake news, we ended up mostly talking about science and the way that belief works. So it's not a festival of complaining about the other person, right? We're not moaning about the state of the universe. We're really investigating how belief works and how communities affect what we know and what we decide to find out.
The authors of The Misinformation Age are Kaylin O'Connor. She's a philosopher of biology and behavioral sciences. And James Owen Weatherall is a physicist, philosopher, and mathematician. So you've got an interesting combination of thinkers here.
Those titles are not intimidating at all. I don't hear that and think, wow, I don't know anything.
So let's talk about this. Let's break it down a bit. Objectivity versus subjectivity here.
So traditionally, philosophy has been concerned with knowledge. What do you know and what's true? And one of the things that makes their work interesting is that they're looking at it from a different perspective. They're asking, first, what do you believe and why do you believe things that are false? Right? False isn't just something that isn't true. False is something that people believe, people encourage, people feel is an accurate representation of their life and of all sorts of things. And so what makes the conversation fascinating is that you get a spectrum of things. Another way to put this is we like to talk about truth in terms of certainty. Something is true because we know it absolutely. But when we believe things, we believe in probability. It's most likely to be true. It's 50% chance that I will get here without a traffic jam, or 80% chance that I will get to class on time without having a car accident. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to be late, I'm not going to hit a traffic jam, I'm not going to get into a car accident. And so our belief is about what's most likely going to happen in the world, and in the instance that we talk about fake news or with these two guests, science, what's most likely an accurate description of how things operate.
So to a philosopher, and you're one, are truth and fact relative terms?
Well, that's a complicated question because there are different theories of truth. But the basic insight for 2,500 years has been that something is true if it's independent of our opinions, our beliefs. So 2 plus 2 equals 4 is true because 2 plus 2 really equals 4. Now, the word fact has come to mean something that our society believes to be true or comes to be true. So let me take a really controversial example. Controversial is the wrong term, but let me take a loaded example. It was a fact 150 years ago that women were less than men, were unequal. Now it's a fact that women are equal, right? I think it is objectively true that men and women are equal, but it wasn't regarded as a fact. And so if we compare fact and truth, what we really get is belief. What do you believe? Do you believe women and men are equal or do you not? And what's the probability that you're right as opposed to your certainty?
Well, we are social animals, so let's talk about this. Why is misinformation so successful in a time when tracking down quality information can be done in almost the speed of light?
Well, let's take a simple example. You're a journalist, you're working for a newspaper, and you look at all these scientific studies. And the scientific study says, animals are made of meat, blood is red, the sky is blue, and then you get something that says bananas can talk. And you're like, oh my God, that's news. Bananas can talk. and you put that in the newspaper. It doesn't matter that this is just one study of 50. It doesn't matter that it hasn't been replicated. It's just interesting. So one of the ways that fake news replicates itself is fake news is more interesting and surprising, so people talk about it. Then everybody on Facebook shares the fact that bananas can talk, and then suddenly everyone believes that bananas can talk, even though a week later you get a study that says bananas can't talk. But then the journalist is looking through the list and sees bananas can't talk, and that's not newsworthy, so they move on.
Well, in journalism classes, it's usually taught as dog bites man is not that interesting. Man bites dog, that's a story.
That's exactly right. And they quote that, in fact, in the book, because what science reporting does and what journalists are interested in is novelty, something different and entertaining. So that's just one of many ways in which the society, the culture, the social networks help us support these fake news. Another way of thinking about it is what's called confirmation bias, where you want to believe something. Let's say you want to believe that all redheads are evil people. Well, you are going to see all sorts of statements about how redheads are wonderful and charitable and nice to be around. And then you hear someone say, redheads are really grumpy. And you say, see, I knew it. Redheads are terrible people. We see the evidence that we want to believe in. We see the ideas that are already connected to our point of view, and it's much harder to sort of internalize things that disagree with us. So this too supports our view. I told you redheads were bad people, and you just build up on that.
Well, let's bore into this a little bit. What does the appeal of misinformation tell us about ourselves?
That's an interesting question. And we didn't have too many conversations about it, but the first thing that it tells us is that we are like other people. There's another thing that they do talk about called conformity bias. That's different than confirmation bias. And conformity bias is the desire we have to be like others. Folks in North Dakota will understand this well, that if everyone in the room says 2 + 2 = 5 and you think that 2 + 2 = 4, there's going to be a part of you that thinks, why am I different? Why do I always disagree? I just want to get along with the crowd. And it influences you. So one of the appeals of fake news is not only that we think we're right about something, but that we get to be like other people. We get to feel comfortable. We don't have to argue. We don't have to fight. And another appeal of fake news is that it helps us win arguments, right? It helps us think that we're smart and that we know what's going on.
Well, we like to have our beliefs affirmed. We like to watch the channel that reflects our beliefs in the news. And we like to go online and check out websites that are affirmative of what we believe.
That's absolutely right. And also, some of it happens almost unconsciously. So they talk about a study that some folks did looking at photos from the Obama inauguration and the Trump inauguration, right? This, if you recall, was a big controversy because there were all sorts of people who said that more people attended the Trump inauguration than anyone in history.
Including the president.
Including the president, right. And if you look at the crowd numbers and you get the photos and you get all of the data, it's perfectly clear that more people were at the Obama inauguration. It's just true. But they did a study and they showed the pictures to Obama supporters and Trump supporters. The Trump supporters looked at the photos and honestly believed that there were more people in the Trump photo. It's not that they were lying. It's not that they were belligerent. It's not that they were being stubborn. They looked at it and they honestly believed it. So what that means is that it's not just that our beliefs are subjective. It's also our perceptions are subjective. The way we look at the world is influenced by how we already see the world. And then that leads to confirmation bias and conformity bias and all of these other things that make it snowball. The thing about fake news, the thing about misinformation, and this is true in science, it's true in politics, it's true in all these different ways, is that it gains its own momentum. So you start with one alternative fact, so to speak, and then you add another and you add another and you add another. There's an old joke in philosophy about logical arguments that says each one of the premises on its own are ridiculous, but taken together, they're irrefutable. and that's how misinformation works. You have these little details which themselves are false, but once you have all of this information feeding off of each other, how can you not believe that it's true?
This sounds like a cynical but logical view of our political process.
It's a cynical but logical view of our knowledge process. And that's actually what's so exciting about the book is they're not just picking on politics. They're looking mostly at the scientific process and the way that scientists who are supposed to be open-minded, super critical, super objective folks are actually just as subjective and just as ego involved as anyone else. Now, they aren't arguing that science doesn't lead to truth. They aren't arguing that, oh, it's all a bunch of malarkey, right? What they're arguing is let's create a map of how people think in order to make the process better. If we can figure out where the shortcomings are, we can figure out how to separate misinformation from true information. And that's, of course, what philosophy tries to do. There's two kinds of philosophy. There's descriptive philosophy, which tries to describe the world as it is, and there's prescriptive philosophy, which tries to prescribe or tell us how we should be. And so they're doing mostly the descriptive stuff, how do networks of society communicate beliefs in order to get towards the end to some prescriptions that we might be able to rely on.
Well, we seem to like authority figures too. And that, for example, the doctor in a couple of generations ago who was suggesting that a certain kind of cigarette was better for you.
That's absolutely right. 4 out of 5 doctors smoke Chesterfields, right? Now we don't even think about that. We think, oh, that's a silly old ad. But in the 1950s, you hear 4 out of 5 doctors smoke Chesterfields. You don't think, oh, my God, doctors are addicts as well, right? You think, oh, Chesterfields must be healthy. You get an actor or a famous sports figure, and they are really good at what they do, then they start talking about someone else or something else, and you think, well, they're good at that. They must know what they're talking about this way. And that's true of scientists too. You have a scientist who's a biologist, and the biologist tells you something about physics. You think they know what they're talking about, even though they're just as much an amateur at physics as you and I are.
Well, these days, when you see some sort of scientific data put out there, you typically look at who's paying for it because that may have a relationship. Scientists can be influenced by industry funding, and I look at the petroleum industry and climate warming change and all that kind of thing. Or politicians, might be influenced by who donates to their campaign.
This is also one of the really interesting aspects of the discussion because when we think about industry messing with scientific results, we think, well, here are these guys in black suits with suitcases of $100 bills slipping to the scientists for them to falsify their research. But most science gets corrupted by a passive process. Scientists have integrity. They're trying to do their work. But if you're working with probabilistic knowledge, let's say cigarettes cause cancer, and let's say you have 20 studies examining whether the rats get cancer. Of those 20 studies, 17 are going to say they get cancer, 3 are not. The industry is going to support or advertise or disseminate the studies that show that they don't. So even though it was a legitimate study, the industry is going to give the money to the real studies that support their conclusion. So that what happens then is that the real studies get more money and become bigger, and those scientists become more powerful and have a larger voice. And the scientists who also got it right but got the results that are more accurate, they get less money. So no one acted nefariously. No one violated scientific integrity. It was just exploited for marketing purposes.
And sometimes that message changes a bit to sort of agree with the way the perception changes. For example, climate change denial seems to have shifted from an outright denial that it's happening to the statement climate change is always changing. There's nothing we can do about it.
That's right. I mean, you and I remember it. I'm sure many of our listeners do, when it was called global warming, right?
Right.
And it is, right? And we talked about global warming, but then people said, well, look out the window. There's you know, 4 feet of snow, so much for global warming. So they said, well, that's not how it works. There's a difference between weather and climate, but let's change the name. Let's call it climate change. And then someone comes along and says, well, but climate's changed all the time. And so then you say, all right, well, it's man-made climate change. And then they say, well, maybe it's man-made, maybe it's not. Prove it to me. Show me absolute, irrefutable, 100% certain proof that it is man-made. You can't do that because science can never show 100% proof of anything, right? If you go back to the beginnings of modern science, the philosopher René Descartes, he tried to prove that you and I exist, and he couldn't. Right. So if I can't prove that this isn't a dream, if I can't prove that I'm actually talking to Doug on the microphone, how can I prove 100% that there's man-made climate change? And so then the deniers are going to say, look, you can't prove it. Therefore, it's too soon to act. Therefore, we don't know anything. And people exploit that little bit of a doubt, even though every single thing we do is laced with that doubt.
So did Descartes – was he the guy who said, I think, therefore I am?
That's absolutely right. The basic argument is, and I'll say it very quickly, that in order to think, there has to be a thinker. So in order to doubt, there has to be a doubter. The proof that we exist is the fact that we are thinking or we are doubting, even though we don't know anything about ourselves. We don't know what we look like. We don't know what we sound like. We don't know who we are. Therefore, I think, therefore I am. I exist because I think, and I know I think because there has to be a thinker. Now, that's a whole other conversation. But Descartes gets to that point, but all he can prove is that there is a thinker, and what he has to do in order to go from there as a thinker to the world as it is say there's a God and God wouldn't do that. God wouldn't deceive us. Now, a lot of people have been dissatisfied with that, but that's irrelevant. The point is you can't prove anything 100%. You can't prove anything 100%, and that opens the door to misinformation.
Yes, and misinformation can actually be dangerous. During times of conflict, propaganda can make people do things they shouldn't do. And these days, we have people who deny the efficacy of vaccinations, you know, or people who call themselves the chosen.
That's absolutely right. So you have everything from the anti-vaccination movement to people who think that a Sikh, which is a South Asian religion where people wear turbans, are Muslims, and then they beat up Sikhs because they want to beat up Muslims. Now, you shouldn't beat up anybody, right? But if you're if you're going to beat up someone, at least you want to beat up the right person, right? And so misinformation distorts everything, and once you get that misinformation, it can become profoundly dangerous. They're, you know, Tide Pods are cookies, right? And then people eat Tide Pods. We can think of silly examples. We can think of trivial examples. We can think of horrendous examples. And the book covers all of them.
Well, does studying how misinformation works protect us from it, you know, by writing a book like this, The Misinformation Age, or does it give people the tools to spread misinformation? Is it diabolical in a sense?
I think this would be a hard book to use as a blueprint for messing with people, in part because it is so scientific and it is so abstract. But this really, I mean, for lack of a better term, the answer to that question is whether or not you're an optimist or a pessimist, right? Every human tool can be used for good and every human tool can be used for evil. Mm-hmm. And do you think knowledge makes the world a better place? I'm a philosopher. I do. I think knowledge can improve the world. There are other people who think, well, the world would be better if people were a little more in the dark. You know, that's a personal choice. The marketers are making a lot of money and they know how to exploit everything. That's why they make a lot more money than I do, right? Because they can take anything and they can manipulate it. I'm just a lowly college professor who's trying to talk about the research that people do. I don't think there's anything in this misinformation that I could use to mess with people. But the experts, they can do anything they want.
Well, as our listeners can tell, this is a deep and important topic. And Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which will be our Prairie Public Presents program Sunday at 5 p.m. Central. And we look forward to listening to the whole thing, Jack. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks as always, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
Some farmers along the Mississippi will do anything to protect their land.
But don't ask your neighbors to flood so you can live off the fat of the land.
Flood Thy Neighbor on the next Reveal.
Reveal coming up Saturday at 1 noon Mountain.
Not everything on this show will always make sense, but it'll be a ton of fun.
A steamed bun was walking down the street one day, and this steamed bun got hungry, so he took a bite of himself, and then he was a steamed stuffed bun.
I have a mystery that I've been trying to solve for the last 45 years.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
The greener it is, the faster it swims.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The world is filled with interesting places, and every place has its wonders. Sometimes, however, we find our surroundings so familiar that we miss the wonder. Chuck Lorre is a teacher and writer who shares his interest in and observations of the natural world in his Natural North Dakota essays. Today's essay is titled Northern Pintails.
One of the earliest ducks to return to North Dakota each spring is the pintail. They often show up when the snow is still on the ground and the ice is not completely off area lakes. They can be easily observed on and adjacent to temporary wetlands in farmers' fields, as well as area marshes and ponds. They're grace in motion. They're even graceful when they're loafing. That gracefulness was not lost on John James Audubon. He made reference to the grace of the northern pintail in his description of the species in his Birds of America, and I quote, "On the water, few birds exhibit more graceful motions than the pintail duck. Its delicately slender neck, the beautiful form of its body, and its pointed tail, which it always carries highly raised, distinguish it from other species with which it may associate." Unquote. Pintails, for those of you unfamiliar with the species, are puddle ducks. They're about the size of a mallard in length, but much thinner. Svelte might be an appropriate term for their body form. The drakes have a chocolate-brown head, white breast, and undersides, which follows upward, forming a narrow white neck stripe. The body is gray with a green wing patch or a speculum. And perhaps the most noticeable characteristic is the long pointed tail that points upward, thus pintail. Linnaeus gave it the scientific name Anas acuta, anus for duck, and acuta, a reference to the long, sharp, or acute angled tail. Females, as with many birds, are rather dull brown in color to help in protective coloration while incubating. Laura Erickson, the noted Minnesota ornithologist, described them as, and I quote, "looking like dignified long-tailed mallard hens," unquote. Mating pairs form long before they arrive here in the spring, and the pair bond will likely last only one season. The nest location may vary from tilled cropland to wet meadows and seasonal wetlands. And if all goes well, the female will lay from 3 to 12 eggs, which will hatch in 22 to 24 days. As with many other waterfowl, the northern pintail populations fluctuate with water conditions, rising in wetter years when wetlands are full of water, and dropping during dry years. However, loss of habitat, particularly wetland drainage, and the conversion of native prairie to crop production continues to be an area of concern. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botno. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly discussion of topics in the news, and Matt Olin will review Unplanned. First, the news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. New voting devices may be on their way for North Dakota in time for next year's election. They're included in the Secretary of State budget, which passed the House. The House has approved spending $12 million for the new devices. $8.2 million will come from the Strategic Infrastructure and Investment Fund, $3 million from the federal government, and $800,000 from fees collected by the Secretary of State's office. This is Grand Forks Republican Representative Mark Sanford.
The current system is 15 years old, certainly is showing its age, In fact, it's so old that you can't get parts, and it just we've been fortunate that we haven't had some kind of an incident over the last couple of elections.
That money will also fund electronic poll books, which will keep the names and addresses of voters. Sanford told the House the upkeep of the new devices and poll books would be the Secretary of State's responsibility, relieving the counties of that burden. The measure passed 84-6. It goes back to the Senate for further consideration. The House has passed a bill that would fund the budget for the State Water Commission, but supporters of the FM diversion project are hoping to change some legislative intent language in that bill. The intent section says state spending on the diversion cannot exceed $703 million, but Fargo lawmakers say that number needs to be $870 million. Fargo Republican Representative Jim Casper voted for the spending bill, but he hopes the intent language can be changed in a House Senate conference committee. Casper told the House, to get the project going this year, there needs to be a P3 agreement, a private-public partnership.
That P3 entity is looking for assurance from the state of North Dakota so that they can sign a contract. If they sign that contract, they guarantee their costs throughout the whole project. There's not going to be any add-ons, and they will start the building. But they haven't told the Fargo Diversion folks and many of the legislators here that there's one key issue that they need in this bill, and that is the words legislative intent for $870 million of state funding.
Republican Representative Bill Twite questioned the project.
I'm not an engineer or hydrologist, but I do know that if you put an obstacle on a piece of flat surface, you're going to change the floodplain. And I really think until Fargo puts a stake in the ground and said we're not going to build out any further, we're never going to solve a flood problem there. You're always going to have to divert water to somebody else.
The bill passed 84-8. It goes back to the Senate for further consideration. And hundreds of faculty, students, and alumni have signed an online petition calling for the University of Colorado Regents to withdraw their support for UND President Mark Kennedy. Kennedy is the lone finalist for the presidency at the University of Colorado. The petition, signed by more than 700 people, says Kennedy has been a contested figure at UND, that missing from his record is any evidence that he has a commitment to higher education. The letter says Colorado's reputation would be damaged if Kennedy is appointed because he doesn't reflect the values of Colorado voters. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This week, the Democrats set a record for the number of declared candidates in a presidential election. So wait, wait, we'll be heading to the Laurie Auditorium in San Antonio because we need a 3,000-seat theater to hold them all. I'm Peter Sagal. Dan Rather will join us for a show crazier than a swarm of bees trying to park a Trader Joe's on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
Well, that old wire machine in the background means it's time to talk about the week's big news stories with our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us every Friday from our microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
Pretty interesting day, I think, because the legislature has overridden one of the vetoes of the governor.
Now, if I'm correct, this is the first override of a veto, and this had to do with the budget section. Now, remember 2 years ago there was a lawsuit?
Yes.
Over the budget section, and the Supreme Court said, well, you know, the way you're doing it is not the right thing. So the legislature wrote rules for how the budget section is going to operate, and Governor Burgum still doesn't like it because he said this is a subset of the legislature. The full legislature should make the decision.
So this is a turf issue.
It is. It has become a turf issue and, you know, a kind of a who's got the power type issue too.
So it sounds like something that might come back for another discussion.
I would not discount that, believe
me. Okay. All right. Interesting, because the governor of North Dakota is somewhat of a weak governor position in many ways. And so this is the legislature sort of pounding its chest a bit, I think.
A bit, yes, exactly.
A bonding bill is still pending in the North Dakota legislature. You reported about that on Tuesday, Dave.
Yeah, I think there are some changes perhaps coming to it. I understand that one of the projects has been dropped and the idea of rebuilding Gamble Hall is back in there. Gamble Hall's at UND. And there are some strings attached that UND has to raise some money, and UND apparently has said, yeah, we can raise some money on that. So watch that one. It's still kind of fluid.
Okay, but these are higher education buildings, some of them long overdue for refreshment or replacement.
Dunbar Hall is still in there, and Dunbar Hall really needs an upgrade. And also that building at Valley City State, which is on the wrong side of the dike.
Uh-oh.
They're going to do that.
Okay. Speaking of the wrong side of the dike and flooding and all that kind of stuff, the legislature is still wrestling with funding for the FM diversion, correct?
Yes, and this has been an interesting debate because if you notice that there's intent language in the bill for the Water Commission that says the legislature has put a $703 million cap into what the state's going to spend. Well, the Fargo delegation is saying, hey, with our P3 project, the private firm wants $850 million to make it work. And if they get an agreement with $850 million, they will set a price that is a set price and no ifs, ands, or buts going forward. So there's more discussion on that, too.
So there's an incentive there if we actually know the price isn't going to keep ballooning up.
Right. But there is still some consternation about some of the things that were done by the FM Diversion Authority by some legislators who say that maybe the FM Diversion Authority went too far too soon.
Well, we were reminded of why the FM diversion is an important topic for lots of people because we've just had another close brush with high water.
Exactly. And, you know, at least the red is now cresting.
Yeah.
Pretty much almost up and down the river, which is good news.
Let's talk about the tsunami that hit the UND campus this week. President Mark Kennedy is looking at Colorado, huh?
Right. And out of the blue, it comes out, and there was whispers in the legislature about it, and all of a sudden, they had to confirm that he was the lone finalist for this presidency at the University of Colorado.
So now he's hanging out there. I mean, it seems like UND is going to be a tough place to fall back on if he doesn't get this job in Colorado.
Right, and remember, there's a 14-day waiting period before he can take the job, before they can actually offer it to him and take the job. But he's basically saying that he's going to be around. But for some reason, if something happens or falls through, I kind of doubt that he will come back to UND.
Yeah, there are some issues there, major donor issues.
Correct.
And governance issues. And then this whole question about this chief of staff who would be working remotely, that raised some eyebrows. And apparently it's generating some news in the Colorado side of this equation too.
Yes, and you have noticed that some of his votes when Mark Kennedy was in the Minnesota congressional delegation, there are some questions being raised by a couple of regents there, but I don't know if there are things that he can't overcome, though.
Well, that was Michelle Bachmann's seat he took over, and that was 6 years in Congress. So he does have a record, I guess.
He does have a record.
Let's talk briefly about the Senate appropriators are questioning how UND will pay for parking projects on the campus.
Interesting, because here is the idea that you're going to give state employees, including the university system personnel, a 2.5% raise with the floor of $120 per month, and UND was at least suggesting that parking fees on campus would be almost tripled. And they're saying, wait a second, this is not what we're about here. And there were some whispers that UND's parking project would have to be canceled.
Huh. It just seems odd. I mean, these days bonds are a pretty good deal.
Right.
And if you want to, sell bonds to create capital structures, the time has never been better almost.
And that's why you're seeing these bonding proposals for buildings and for parking lots and things like that.
Okay. So more discussion about this,
I guess.
And
yeah, I think so.
Lots of head scratching about parking fees, I'm sure about that. That's a tender topic on campuses, generally.
And it is for those of us who got caught by the parking ferry when we were UND students.
That's right. It does happen on campuses.
It does happen.
Even if you visit for a moment, it'll happen.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Let's talk about these landowner rights versus hunting rights. This thing has been much debated at the legislature. You just posted something today on this.
Right. It has festered for a while. And the sponsors in the Senate thought they had a solution. And this was to be to create this electronic database of what lands would be posted, what would not be posted, what lands are open to hunt on. Then there was going to be a landowner and sportsman group that was going to look at some other solutions to get more of a comedy, if you want, between hunters and landowners. Well, it kind of fell apart in the House when they did a parliamentary move to divide the question, and the things about landowners' rights did pass. But the idea of this posting of land and, you know, doing the electronic posting, that fell apart. That's out of the bill. It's probably going to a conference committee, and we'll see what can come out of that.
And that would have created some kind of like a smartphone app so you could just
– Correct. You could basically say, hey, here's where I am. Is this land open for hunting?
And why are people opposed to that?
It's not so much that. It's that there is a landowner rights, shall we say, movement that they think that some in the hunting community may be overstepping their bounds about hunting, and that land that is posted, well, there are hunters that are going on the land. That's their concern. And most hunters say, hey, we at least ask, or we try to figure out if land is posted or not. So.
Well, I mean,
it's really a long-standing, shall we say, tug and pull.
Yeah, and I know this has been going on for some time. I once owned some wilderness land that we did post, though it was onerous to do that because it was kind of tough land to walk around. But it was either that or, you know, a hide indoors during high-powered hunting season. So.
Right.
So that there's an interesting tension here.
There is a tension, and you know there's a real right to hunt in North Dakota. It's almost part of the legacy of North Dakota that, you know, hunters' rights are there, but at some point it clashes with property rights, and that's where the rub is.
Well, let's talk about a story you posted yesterday. Women's suffrage celebration begins in North Dakota, and then I add to this sort of the phrase the irony.
Yeah, there's more than a bit of irony in that, is that there is a group that's going to be celebrating and working on a two-year celebration of women's suffrage in North Dakota and how that came about. And at the same time, a few weeks ago, the legislature voted to rescind the ERA, which may have run out of time or may not have run out of time. They said it was more symbolic than anything else, but it was a symbol that showed, you know, at least some women that, you know, there's some concerns about that.
Yeah. It seems odd that this would be such a potent issue still.
Yes. And it's very interesting because there are some really interesting things in North Dakota history about women's suffrage and about how Linda Slaughter played a role in that. And you remember that name.
Well, I remember the name. Refresh our memory, though, on what she did.
Well, she was one who was campaigning for women's rights, and at one point they had a measure saying that women could at least vote in school board elections, but not in the general elections. And then along came the amendment to the Constitution, which was, I believe, the 19th Amendment.
All right. And producer Skip Wood just reminded me that next year our Dakota Date book, heard every day here on Main Street, will feature suffrage. So
absolutely.
Stay tuned.
Wonderful. Yes.
Okay. Here's an odd story from Danielle Webster on Wednesday. Hotel hot tub in Castleton linked to cases of Legionnaire's disease.
I know. That was out of the blue. We hadn't heard anything about Legionnaire's disease for a while, but all of a sudden they did some testing in a hot tub, and that's because people came down with symptoms of Legionnaire's, and they discovered that the bacteria was there. They shut down the hot tub, did a thorough cleaning of it, and did several inspections. Finally, it's passed inspections, and you can go into the hot tub again at that Castleton Hotel.
Well, it is a hot tub. I just remind you of that.
Yes, exactly.
Look around the pool. Who do you want to share the hot tub with? Okay. How about this day park plan for the Missouri River near Bismarck having been revived this week?
Okay, this has a little history to it. Remember what happened in the 2015 session? They wanted to do this day park down there, and the corrections department wanted to give up some of its land down there.
Mm-hmm.
So they got 300 acres, and they were going to create a day park where you could go, you know, not have softball diamonds or camping or things like that, but more of a nature-type park, something similar to what Winnipeg has. And that was approved, and then we had financial troubles, 15 and 17, and the parks department did not have money to get the day park set up. And all of a sudden, a new governor comes in, a new parks director, and corrections wanted it back. Well, they passed a measure saying, okay, this is going to Parks and Recreation in perpetuity. And that's what's in the bill. It's not finally passed yet, but at least it has gone through the House.
Well, let's close our discussion with this amended bill that would make it easier to cite large animal feeding operations. This is a contentious subject as well.
And it's going to continue to be contentious because the House made the changes in that, which basically if you read it away, it takes away a lot of local control over where these hog farms can be sited. Now, there are Senate sponsors, and I've talked to a few of the Senate sponsors who are not happy with this. This is going to be a conference committee to watch.
Okay, because this is a sort of a local state issue, and
exactly.
There's some strong differences of opinion on
there
it.
There are. That's right.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Christine Baranski on making her television debut on Sybil.
No one had seen that woman on American television. Sex and the City came later. The woman with the martini and her outfits and her attitude, that was the first of its kind, and it changed my career.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
That's coming up tomorrow at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. That fanfare says it all, but this movie's a little different than the ones you usually go to, Matt.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot that I wanted to see this week, and so I decided to kind of step out of my box, step out of my comfort zone, and go see the movie Unplanned. Now, this is the anti-abortion film made by the Pure Flix production company, which does faith-based films. And I thought, well, let's go see what this is about, because it has made a significant amount of money considering there's basically been no advertising for it. That's a whole other separate topic of controversy of why there has not been advertising.
It's been getting a fair amount of social media play, yeah, and all that stuff.
We don't have time to get into that here, but this is based on Abby Johnson's memoir. Now, Abby Johnson was a Planned Parenthood clinic director in Texas who eventually quit and became a pro-life activist. So Ashley Bratcher plays Abby. Ashley Bratcher is a professionally trained actress. She's actually not too bad in the film. She has a lot of emotion she has to call up. She's good at that. She's also a pro-life activist. So these are the kind of films that she does. The first scene of the film, which I need to explain, which is crucial, is the revelation point. And then we get flashbacks to her becoming part of Planned Parenthood. The controversial scene is when she's asked to assist in the surgery room one day, which she's usually not asked to do. And there's a 13-week fetus being aborted. And as she watches the ultrasound, it almost becomes a cartoon animated figure where we see the fetus fighting and struggling for its life as the doctor says, quote, "Beam me up, Scotty." Now, I would hope a doctor would not say such a thing in an operating room. Again, my radar of watching a lot of movies suggests that is an embellished line. And it's done for effect to make this abortion doctor seem more evil than he's already being portrayed as in the film. So in the scene, this is the moment where she sees the fetus struggle. Now, I have done some research on this, and doctors who are experts in this say that is not possible for a 13-week fetus to feel pain. So this scene is in dispute. Is this what Abby Johnson really saw? Is she embellishing what she saw based on her memoir to kind of heighten things? I don't know. I'm not here to say that. What I can say is this scene is in major dispute by doctors who know what's going on, no matter what side of the abortion debate you're on. The other part of the film that becomes cartoonish, Doug, is the portrayal of Abby's boss. When she first works at the clinic, her boss is a woman named Cheryl. I don't know if this is a real person or a composite character, as we sometimes get in films, as you know, Doug. It's played by Robiah Scott. Let's just say Hitler has fared better in films than Robiah Scott's portrayal of Cheryl fares in this film.
Wow.
She is the epitome of evil. Scott plays her with a maniacal zeal that's quite over the top. There's one of these scenes where I believe is completely embellished, where Abby Johnson is pregnant in the film and she's married. And Scott says to her flippantly in the bathroom, "I can take care of that for you."
Goodness.
Now, I would hope this line never happened from her boss. I suspect maybe that's an embellishment as well. But again, I'm not here to say. It just feels like this is a line that her boss would never have said to her. Her boss even tries to talk her out of the pregnancy because it's going to interfere with her career path. So I do sense there's a lot of embellishment going on here. basically, quality-wise, Doug, it comes off like a Lifetime movie with a C-list cast and probably a lot more gore than Lifetime movies have. So again, this is for the true believers. This is a film made for pro-life people to go see. I don't see one pro-choice person getting converted by this film at all. So that's what it's made for. It is finding an audience, a small audience, but still a faithful audience. Look, as a piece of filmmaking, it's below average. Some of the acting is really poor when you get to the secondary leads. Because again, the people doing these films, not a lot of SAG actors are probably going to sign up for a film like this. They're just not. And so you're probably not getting the cream of the crop in terms of actors. Ashley Bratcher isn't bad in the part. As I said, Robaya Scott is completely over the top as the clinic director.
But what you have here is a movie that's rated R, of all things. And that, I think, was a bit of a controversy when it came out.
It is a controversy. I will say this. I don't know that this should have been an R rating. I think maybe PG-13, considering some of the violent films that do get PG-13. As I said, the scene in dispute almost comes off as a cartoon animation figure. So the scene is horrifying and also laughable in the same breath because of the effect that you're seeing on screen, again, doesn't seem true. It doesn't seem like that would happen to the 13-week fetus. I don't know. I'm just quoting the doctors who have seen the film that know this, that say that is not possible that Abby Johnson could have seen what she saw in that scene.
But it's playing well to the choir, I take it.
It is playing well to the choir. There's been a lot of controversy over networks that have not aired the trailer. Fox News did air the trailer. Others have refused to air the trailer. It's made about $13 million so far. The directors are Kerry Solomon and Chuck Konzelman. The hook of the film, Doug, as you know, is Abby Johnson was a clinic director, and then she wrote this memoir. So for the pro-life group out there that's going, that's the hook of this film. She got on the inside. She got inside the walls. She knows what happens inside those walls. That's the big reveal, is that this isn't just a film seen through the eyes of protesters, and they are in the film. They're outside the gate. They come off very kindly and gentle, and they try to work on Abby because they kind of sense that maybe she's not completely 100% with the Planned Parenthood cause. There's some other things that are in dispute. Planned Parenthood has released a statement saying there's a lot of falsehoods in this film, specifically the contention from Abby that they do push abortions.
Well, the more interesting issue here, I think, always, this human issue, is that personal decision that the woman is making.
In the film, I can tell you, Doug, the women having abortions come off as sympathetic figures. So they don't demonize them. The filmmakers demonize the clinic director part. That's the ultimate demonization, is Planned Parenthood and the character played by Robaya Scott, which comes off as one of the more cartoonish villains I've seen on screen in about the last 5 or 10 years.
So probably not some Oscar acting awards.
Oh, no, no,
for
no.
This.
No, this, okay. There's no awards here. If you're a pro-life person, you may want to check it out. If you're pro-choice, I would say don't check it out. I think I can be safe to say with those two recommendations.
Well, let's go to our Oscar trivia question. The only films, there are two of them, to win 3 Academy Awards for acting are
Network, 1976, and A Streetcar Named Desire, 1951. I can give you the people.
Please do.
Faye Dunaway and Network, Peter Finch, who won posthumously, died of a heart attack promoting the film, and Beatrice Straight and Streetcar, Carl Malden, Kim Hunter, and Vivian Leigh. And Brando was the only one not to win the Oscar, even though his performance, as you know, Doug, is probably the most famous performance from Streetcar.
And William Holden was nominated as best actor in a leading role for Network, too. So kind of interesting connection there.
And lost to Peter Finch. And when Finch announces the winner that night, Holden, you can tell, is very pleased that Finch wins because, you know, he had passed on by then. And Holden already had an Oscar.
We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
The appointment of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court has led to a surge in anti-abortion legislation across the country.
We see the court as being much more favorable to pro-life legislation than it has been in a generation.
But some state lawmakers who consider themselves pro-life are voting down bills they say are too radical. A fight over tactics in the anti-abortion movement. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered begins at 4 Central, 3 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 12th.
A briquette is a compressed block of combustible material, such as charcoal or sawdust. The term is French and related to the word brick. Briquettes are a way to use small coal, the finely broken coal bits produced during mining. These small bits were difficult both to ship and to burn. Forming it into briquettes solved the problem. But initially, the process was not very efficient. It could be done by using wet clay as a binder, but then it didn't burn very well. The first coal briquette factory was built in France in 1859. The goal was to form the waste material into pieces nearly identical in size, shape, and weight. An improvement in the process came during the rapid industrialization of the Victorian age, when inventions like the hydraulic press made it possible to compress the bits of coal into high-quality briquettes. The mass-produced briquettes were economical and easy to store, ship, and burn. On this date in 1907, the Washburn Leader informed readers that the New Salem Mercantile Company of New Salem, North Dakota, had contacted the National Fuel Briquette Machinery Company of New York City. The New Salem Company had sent a sample of North Dakota lignite for a test. Fred Leonard, representing New Salem Mercantile, explained that the test would determine whether the machines would properly form North Dakota coal into bricks. If the test was successful, a representative would come to North Dakota to meet with miners and explain the advantages of the brick-making machines. The briquette company's machines did, indeed, have an impressive track record. The New York Central and Hudson Railway had ordered 3 machines to form bricks from anthracite coal dust. A Texas company had purchased several for a new plant that would use lignite coal. Briquetting North Dakota lignite did catch on for a while, including a Royal Oak factory, a name still associated with briquettes, familiar to backyard grillers everywhere, though there doesn't appear to be any continuing connection to North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
All throughout the winter of 1944, these strange parachute things just start appearing in the skies all over America.
On the next radio lab,
this whistling sound over their heads. The War Department destroyed all of the evidence.
He said, "Do not talk to anybody about anything that you've heard here."
The war on our shore.
Time out, what?
That's on the next radio lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we'll talk with Jen Hobbs, the author of American Hemp, How Growing Our Newest Cash Crop Can Improve Our Health, Clean Our Environment, and Slow Climate Change. And will the recent storm create additional flood threats? That's the type of question that drones can help answer. And we'll talk about drones with Terry Zimmerman, CEO of Botlink, and Joey Schmidt, CEO of Flight Pros ND. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.